She was counted among the SOB, souls on board, when the lads took off, but she certainly wasn't authorized to be there chivying along the novice bombing crews as they practiced low-flying over the high moors. So, various off- and on-duty concerned people came pelting out of offices and the men's and ladies' tea huts, coatless and white-faced, when they saw Maddie's RAF mates chairlifting her in their arms across the runway. A WAF friend of hers called Joan, and the guilty squadron leader reached her first. "What's wrong? What's happened? Is she hurt?" Maddie was not hurt. She was already badgering the Wellington crew who carried her to put her down.
"Get off, everyone will see, the girls will never let me forget it."
"What happened?" Maddie struggled to her feet and stood shivering on the concrete.
"We got fired on,"
she said, and looked away, burning with shame at how much it had taken out of her.
"Fired on?"
barked the squadron leader. This was in the spring of 1940, the war was still in Europe. It was before the disastrous May when the Allies fled, retreating to the French beaches. Before the siege that was the Battle of Britain, before the thunder and flame-filled nights of the Blitz. In the spring of 1940, our skies were alert and armed and uneasy. But they were still safe.
"Yes, fired on!" echoed the Wellington pilot in fury.
He was white as a sheet too.
"By those idiots manning the anti-aircraft guns at the Catacut barrage balloons. By our own gunners! Who the hell's training them? Bloody daft, trigger-happy morons, wasting ammo and scaring the blue bleeding daylights out of everybody. Any school lad can spot the difference between a flying cigar and a flying pencil."
"We call our jolly Wellingtons flying cigars, and we call your nasty Dorniers flying pencils. Have fun translating, Miss E." The pilot had been as scared as Maddie, but he was not shaking. Joan put a comforting arm around Maddie's shoulders and advised her in a whisper to pay no attention to the pilot's language. Maddie gave an uncertain and forced laugh. "Wasn't even sitting in the gun turret," she muttered. "Thank goodness I'm not flying into Europe." Signals branch. "Flight Lieutenant Mottram has been singing your praises," Maddie's WAF section officer told her. "He says you've got the sharpest pair of eyes at Oakway." The section officer rolled her own eyes. "Probably a bit of an exaggeration, but he said that in flight you're always the first to spot another aircraft approaching. How do you fancy further training?"
"In what?"
The section officer coughed apologetically. "It's a bit secret. Well, very secret. Say yes and I'll send you on the course."
"Yes," Maddie said.
To clarify a remark someone made earlier, I confess that I am making up all the proper nouns. Did you think I remembered all the names and ranks of everybody Maddie ever worked with? Or every plane she ever flew in? I think it is more interesting this way. That is all I can usefully write today, though I would keep on blethering about nothing if I thought that by doing it I could avoid the next few hours' cross-examination. Engel struggling over my handwriting and von Linden picking holes in everything I've said. It must be done. No point in putting it off. I have a blanket to look forward to afterwards, I hope. Perhaps a tepid dish of Kilkenny à la guerre. That is, cabbage and potato mash without the potato and with not very much cabbage. I have not got scurvy yet anyway, thanks to France's infinite supply of prison cabbage. Hey-ho. Or May. 10-11-43. JBS.
RAF. WAF. RDF, Y. SOB, SOE. Assistant SO Flight Officer. W/OP. CLK/SD. Mayday, Mayday, Mayday.
Coastal Defense. Actually, I'm afraid to write this. I don't know why I think it matters. The Battle of Britain is over. Hitler's planned invasion, Operation Sea Lion, failed 3 years ago. And soon he will be fighting a desperate war on two fronts with the Americans behind us and the Russians closing in on Berlin from the east and organized resistance in all the countries in the middle. I can't believe his advisors don't already know what went on in the makeshift huts of iron and concrete up and down the southeast coast of England in the summer of 1940. in a general sense at any rate. Only I don't really want to go down in history as the one who gave out the details. RDF is Range and Direction Finding. Same acronym as Radio Direction Finding, to confuse the enemy, but not exactly the same thing. As you know. Well, they call it radar now, an American word. An acronym of Radio Detection and Ranging, which I do not think is easier to remember. In the summer of 1940, it was still so new nobody knew what it was, and so secret that... Buckets of blood. I can't do this. I have spent a vexing half hour scrapping with Fraulein Engel over the pen nib, which I swear I did not bend on purpose the first time. It is true that it spared me having to continue for a good long while, but it did not move things along for that harpy to straighten it out against my teeth when I could have easily done it myself against the table. It is also true that it was stupid of me to bend it out of shape again, on purpose, the second she handed it back to me. Then she had to show me several times how when she was at school the nurse would use a pen nib to make a pinprick for a blood test. I don't know why I bent the stupid thing again. It is so easy to wind Miss Engel up. She always wins, but only because my ankles are tied to my chair. Well, and also because at the end of every argument she reminds me of the deal I made with a certain officer of the Gestapo, and I collapse.
Hauptsturmfuhrer von Linden is busy, as you know, and will not wish to be interrupted, but I have been told to summon him if necessary. You have been given pen and paper by his judgment of your willingness to cooperate with him, and if you will not write out the confession you have agreed, he will have no choice but to resume your interrogation.
Just shut up, Anna Engel. I know.
I will do anything. She only has to mention his name, and I remember now I will do anything, anything, to avoid him interrogating me again. So, range and direction finding. Coastal defense. Do I get my 30 pieces of silver? No. Just some more of this hotel stationery. It is very nice to write on. Coastal Defense, the unabridged version. We saw it coming. Someone saw it coming. We were that little bit ahead of you and you didn't realize it. You didn't realize how advanced the RDF system was already, or how quickly we were training people to use it, or how far we could see with it. You didn't even realize how quickly we were building new planes of our own. It is true we were outnumbered. But with RDF, we saw you coming. Saw the swarms of Luftwaffe aircraft even as they were leaving their bases in occupied France. Worked out how high they were flying. Saw how many of them were making the raid. And that gave us time to rally. We could meet you in the air. Beat you back, keep you from landing, distract you till your fuel ran out, and you turned tail until the next wave. Our besieged island, alone, on the edge of Europe. Maddie was sworn to secrecy on the life of her unborn children. It's so secret they don't give you a title when you have anything to do with radar. You're just called a special duties clerk. Clerk, special duties. CLK stroke SD for short. Like W stroke OP is for wireless operator. And Y for wireless. CLK stroke SD. That's possibly the most useful and damning piece of information I've given you. Now you know. Maddie spent 6 weeks in radar training. She was also given a very nice promotion and made an officer. Then she was posted to RAF Maid's End, an operational base for a squadron of new Spitfire fighter planes, not far from Canterbury, near the Kentish coast. It was the furthest she had ever been from home. Maddie was not actually put to work at a radar screen in one of the direction-finding stations, though Maid's End did have one. She was still in the radio room. In the fire and fury of the summer of 1940, Maddie sat in a tower of iron and concrete,
taking bearings over the telephone. The other RDF girls did the ID work on the glass screens with the blinking green lights and wired or telephoned it to operations. Then, when operations identified approaching aircraft for her, Maddie answered air-to-ground radio calls as the aircraft came limping home. Or sometimes roaring home in triumph, or newly delivered from the maintenance depot at Swinley. Swinley. At Swinley. Thibault has made me finish writing the name. I'm so ashamed of myself, I want to be sick again. Engel says impatiently not to bother about the name of the workshop. There have been repeated attempts to bomb it to bits, and it's not really a secret. Engel is sure our Hauptsturmfuhrer will be more interested in my sample description of the early radar network. She is cross with T now for interrupting. I hate them both. Hate them all. I hate them. Coastal defense, damn it. Sniveling idiot. So, on the RDF screen, you'd see a green dot for an aircraft, one or two, moving across the screen. It might be ours. You'd watch a battle building, the dots multiplying, more joining the first as the pulsing lights swept the screen. They'd come together and some of them would go out, like the cinders of sparklers. And every green flash that disappeared was a life finished. One man for a fighter, a whole crew for a bomber. Out, out, brief candle. That is from Macbeth. He is said to be another of my unlikely ancestors, and actually did hold court on my family's estate from time to time. He was not, by all contemporary Scottish accounts, the treacherous bastard Shakespeare makes him out to be. Will history remember me for my MBE, my British Empire honour for chivalry, or for my cooperation with the Gestapo? I don't want to think about it. I expect they can take the MBE away if you stop being chivalrous. If they were radio-equipped, Maddie could talk to the planes the special duties clerks saw on their screens. She'd tell the pilots more or less what she'd have told them back at Oakway, except she didn't know landmarks so well in Kent. She'd pass bearings to the moving aircraft, along with wind speed and whether or not there were holes in the runway today. Sometimes we got raided. Or she'd tell other planes to give priority to the one that had lost its flaps, or whose pilot had a lump of shrapnel lodged in his shoulder or something like that. Maddie was listening for incoming stragglers one afternoon, following a battle that hadn't involved the Maid's End squadron. She nearly fell off her chair when she heard the desperate call that came in on her frequency. Mayday! Mayday! Recognizable in English. Or perhaps that was French. Mayday! Help me! The rest of the transmission was in German. The voice was a boy's voice, young and scared. He broke off each call with a sob. Maddie swallowed. She had no idea where the anguished cries for help were coming from. Maddie called out, "Listen! Listen!" and switched her headset onto the tannoy so that everyone could hear, and then she grabbed the telephone. "It's Assistant Section Officer Broddett in the tower. Can I get directly through to Jenny in special duties?" "All right, Tessa, then. Anyone with a screen going. I need an ident on a radio call." Everyone crowded round the telephone, reading over Maddie's shoulder as she took notes from the direction-finding station, then gasping aloud as the meaning of her notes sank in. "Heading straight for Maid's End. What if it's a bomber? What if it's still loaded? What if it's a hoax?" He'd be calling in English if it was a hoax. "Anyone speak German?" shouted the officer in charge of the radio room. Silence. "Christ! Broddett, stay on the phone. Davenport, you run to the wireless station. Perhaps one of those girls can help. Get me a German speaker, now!" Maddie listened with her heart in her mouth, holding her headset to one ear and the telephone to the other, waiting for the girl at the RDF screen to pass her new information. "Shh," warned the radio officer, leaning over Maddie's shoulder and taking hold of the telephone receiver for her so her right hand was freed up for taking notes. "Don't say anything. Don't let him know who's listening." The door to the radio room banged open, and the subordinate Davenport was back, with one of the WAF wireless operators hard on his heels. Maddie looked up. The girl was immaculate, not a blue thread out of place. her chignon of long fair hair coiled in regulation neatness 2 inches above her uniform collar. Maddie recognized her from the canteen and rare social evenings. Queenie, people called her, though she was not the official WAF Queen Bee. That's what we call the senior administrative officer on the base. Nor was it her name. Maddie did not know her real name. Queenie had acquired a certain reputation for being fast and fearless. She sauced superior officers and got away with it, but equally, she wouldn't leave a building during an air raid until she'd made sure everyone else was out. Distantly connected to royalty, she was of some rank herself, of privilege rather than experience, a flight officer. But she was said to work as diligently at her wireless set as any self-made shop girl. She was pretty, petite and light on her feet, and if there was a squadron dance on a Saturday night, she was the one the pilots went for. "Let's have your headset, Broddett," said the radio officer. Maddie uncurled the gripping earphones and microphone and passed her headset to the pretty little blonde wireless operator, who adjusted the phones to fit her head. After a few seconds, Queenie said, "He says he's over the English Channel. He's looking for Calais."
"But Tessa says he's approaching the coast at Whitsable."
"He's in a Heinkel bomber, and his crew's been killed, and he's lost an engine, and he wants to land at Calais." They all stared at the wireless operator.
"You sure we're all talking about the same aircraft?" the radio officer asked dubiously.
"Tessa," Maddie said into the telephone,
"could the German plane be over the channel?"
Now the whole room held its breath, waiting for Tessa's disembodied reply as, somewhere underneath the chalk cliffs, she sat staring at the green flashes on her screen. Her answer appeared beneath Maddie's scribbling pencil. "Hostile ident, track 187, Maid's End 25 miles, est height 8,500 feet.
"Why the hell does he think he's over the English Channel?"
"Oh!" Maddie gave a sudden gasp of understanding and waved at the enormous map of southeast England and northwest France and the Low Countries that covered the wall behind her radio.
"Look! Look, he's come from Suffolk! He's been bombing the coastal bases there! He crossed the mouth of the Thames at its widest point and he thinks he's crossed the channel! He's heading straight for Kent and he thinks it's France!"
The chief radio officer gave the wireless operator a command.
"Answer him."
"You'll have to tell me the protocol, sir."
"Broddett, give her the correct protocol."
Maddie swallowed. There wasn't really any time to hesitate. She said,
"What did he say he's flying? What kind of aircraft? His bomber."
The wireless operator said the name in German first, and they all looked at her blankly.
"HE-111? She translated hesitantly. "Heinkel, HE-111, any other ID?"
"A Heinkel HE-111. He didn't say."
"Just repeat back to him the type of his aircraft. Heinkel HE-111, that's an open reply. You press this button before you talk, keep it pressed while you're talking or he won't be able to hear you, then let go when you're done or he won't be able to reply."
The chief radio officer clarified.
"Heinkel HE-111, this is Marc de Calais. Calais, tell him we are Marc de Calais."
Maddie listened as the wireless operator made her first radio call, in German, as cool and crisp as if she'd been giving radio instructions to Luftwaffe bombers all her life. The Luftwaffe boy's voice responded in a gasp of gratitude, practically weeping with relief. The wireless operator turned to Maddie. "He wants bearings for landing."
"Tell him this." Maddie scribbled numbers and distances on her notepad. "Say his ID first, then yours. Heinkel, HE-111, this is Calais. Then runway, wind speed, visibility." She scribbled notes furiously. The wireless operator stared at the coded abbreviations, then spoke into the headset, giving orders in German with confident calm. She paused mid-flow and jabbed a perfectly manicured fingernail into the script Maddie had passed to her. She mouthed silently.
"R-27? Runway 27, Maddie said under her breath. "Say, cleared straight in. Runway 27. Tell him to dump his leftover bombs in the sea if he's got any, so he doesn't set them off when he lands." The whole of the radio room was silent, mesmerized by the sharp, precisely spoken and incomprehensible instructions that the elegant wireless operator rapped out with the careless authority of a headmistress, and the anguished, equally incomprehensible gasped answers of the boy in the ruined plane, and Maddie scribbling directions and the protocol for giving them on the diminishing notepad.
"Here she comes," breathed the chief radio officer, and everybody excepting Maddie and the wireless operator, whose heads were tied to the telephone and the radio headset, went running to the long window to watch the Heinkel bomber limping into view.
"When he calls final approach, just pass him the wind speed," Maddie instructed, scribbling furiously. 8 knots west-southwest, gusting to 12.
"Tell him the fire service is on its way to meet him," said the radio officer.
He clapped one of the other radio operators on the shoulder.
"Get the engines out there, and an ambulance."
The black silhouette in the distance grew larger. Then they could hear it, coughing and whining on its single belabored engine.
"Christ, he hasn't got the undercarriage down," gasped the young flying officer called Davenport. "This is going to be one hell of a prang."
But it wasn't. The Heinkel pancaked in neatly on its belly in a shower of grass and turf, and came to rest right in front of the control tower, with the fire engines and pumps and an ambulance screaming up to meet it. Everyone at the window went pelting down the stairs and out onto the runway. Maddie put her headset back on. The two other radio operators were on their feet at the window. Maddie strained to hear what was going on and heard only sirens. Away from the window, she could see sky and the windsock at the end of the runway, but not anything immediately below her. A thin thread of curling black smoke drifted up past the window. Outside, at the edge of the runway, Queenie, or whatever her name was, stood staring at the wreck of the Luftwaffe bomber. Floundering on its belly, it was like a vast metallic whale spouting smoke instead of seawater. The wireless operator could see, through the shattered plexiglass of the cockpit, the young pilot desperately trying to free his dead navigator from a torn and bloody helmet. She watched as a swarm of fitters and the fire service team closed in to lift the pilot and the rest of his lifeless crew out of the plane. And she saw the frank relief on the pilot's face turn to bewilderment and apprehension as he was increasingly surrounded by blue uniforms and the stripes and badges of the Royal Air Force. The chief radio officer at her shoulder tut-tutted under his breath.
"Poor young Jerry bastard," he intoned. "He won't go home a hero, will he? Must have no sense of direction whatsoever."
He put a kind hand lightly on the German-speaking wireless operator's shoulder.
"If you don't mind," he said apologetically, "we could use your help questioning him."
Maddie was going off duty by the time the ambulance men had finished hurriedly patching up the German pilot and brought him into the ground floor office of the control tower. She caught a glimpse of the dazed young man, sipping gingerly at a steaming mug, while an orderly lit a cigarette for him. They had wrapped him in a blanket, and it was August, but his teeth were still chattering. The pretty blonde wireless operator was perched on the edge of a hard chair at the other side of the room, politely looking away from this shattered and grief-stricken enemy. She was smoking a cigarette of her own as she waited to be given further instruction. She looked just as poised and calm as she had been when she took the headset from Maddie in the radio room, but Maddie could see her casually drilling the back of her chair with one restless, manicured forefinger. "I couldn't have done what she just did," Maddie thought. "We'd not have made this catch without her. Never mind speaking German, I couldn't have faked it like that. Just off the top of my head, no training or anything. Not sure I could manage what she's going to have to do next either. Thank goodness I don't speak German." That night, Maid's End was raided again. It wasn't anything to do with the captured Heinkel bomber. It was just an ordinary air raid. The Luftwaffe doing their worst to try to destroy British defences. The RAF officers' quarters were blown up, no officers in it at the time, and great big holes gouged out of the runways. The WAF officers were quartered in the gatehouse lodge at the edge of the estate grounds that the airfield had been built on, and Maddie and her bunkmates were so dead asleep they didn't hear the sirens. They only woke up after the first explosion. They ran through scrub woodland to the nearest shelter in their pajamas and tin hats, clutching gas masks and ID cards. There was no light to see by except the gunfire and the exploding flames, No street lamps, no cracks of light in any doors or windows, not even the glow of a cigarette end. It was like being in hell. Nothing but shadows and jumping flames and fire and stars overhead. Maddie had grabbed an umbrella. Gas mask, tin hat, ration coupons, and an umbrella. Hellfire raining down on her out of the sky, and she held it off with a brolly. No one realized she had it, of course, until she was struggling to get it in the door of the air raid shelter.
Shut it! Shut the damn thing! Leave it! I'm not leaving it! Maddie cried, and managed to wrestle the umbrella inside.
The girl behind her pushed, and one of the girls ahead of her grabbed her by the arm and pulled, and then they were all trembling in the dark, underground, with the door shut. A couple of them had had the sense to grab their cigarettes. They passed them around, parsimoniously sharing. There was not a single lad about. The men were quartered half a mile away on the other side of the airfield and used a different shelter, those that weren't scrambling into aircraft to fight back. The girl with the matches found a candle, and they all settled down for the duration.
Bring us that deck of cards, love. Let's have a round of rummy.
Rummy? Don't be soft. Poker. We'll play for ciggies.
For gosh sakes, put that brolly down, brother. Are you completely bonkers?
No, Maddie said very calmly. They were all crouched on the dirt floor around the playing cards and glowing tobacco ends. It was cozy, in perhaps the way you'd be cozy in hell. Something flying low was peppering the runway with machine gun fire. Even buried mostly underground, even a quarter of a mile away, the shelter's iron walls shuddered.
Glad I'm not on shift right now.
Pity the poor souls who are.
Can I share your umbrella? Maddie looked up. Crouched next to her, in the light of the flickering candle and one oil lamp, was the small German-speaking wireless operator. She was a vision of feminine perfection and heroism, even in her WAF regulation-issue men's pajamas, her fair hair tumbling in a loose plait over one shoulder. Everybody else was shedding hairpins. Queenie's hairpins marched in ordered rank on her pajama pocket and would not go back in her hair till she was back in bed. With her slender, perfectly manicured fingers, she offered Maddie her cigarette.
"Wish I'd brought a brolly," she drawled in the plummy, educated tones of the Oxbridge colleges.
Super idea. A portable illusion of shelter and safety. Have you room for two?
Maddie took the cigarette, but did not immediately move over. The Fay Queenie, Maddie knew, was given to fits of madness such as stealing malt whiskey from the RAF officer's mess. And Maddie was sure that anyone bold enough to impersonate an enemy radio operator on the spur of the moment was entirely capable of mocking someone who burst into tears every time she heard a gun fired. On a military airfield. In a war. But Queenie didn't seem to be making fun of Maddie. Quite the opposite. Maddie budged over a little and made room for another body beneath the umbrella.
Marvelous! Queenie cried out happily. Like being a tortoise. They ought to make these out of steel. Let me hold it up.
She gently prized the handle out of Maddie's trembling hand and held the ridiculous umbrella up over both their heads inside the bunker. Maddie took a drag on the offered cigarette. After a while of alternately biting her nails and smoking the borrowed cigarette down to a sliver of paper and ash, her hands stopped trembling. Maddie said hoarsely, "Thank you."
"Not a problem," said Queenie. "Why don't you play this round? I'll cover you."
"What were you on Civvy Street, then?" Maddie asked casually.
"An actress."
The little wireless operator dissolved in a fit of gleeful laughter, but still steadfastly held up the umbrella over Maddie's head.
"No, I just like pretending," she said. "I do the same thing with our own boys, you know. Flirting's a game. I'm very boring, really. I'd be at university if it weren't for the war. I've not quite finished my first year. I started a year early and a term late."
"Reading what?"
"German, obviously. They spoke it, well, an odd variant, in the village where I went to school in Switzerland. And I liked it."
Maddie laughed.
"You were wizard this afternoon. Really brilliant."
"I couldn't have done it without you telling me what to say. You were brilliant, too.
You were right there when I needed you. Not a word or call out of place. You made all the decisions. All I had to do was pay attention, and that's what I do all day on the Y-sets anyway. Just listen and listen. I never have to do anything. And all I had to do this afternoon was read from the script you gave me. You had to translate.
We did it together, said her friend.
People are complicated. There's so much more to everybody than you realize. You see someone in school every day, or at work, in the canteen, and you share a cigarette or a coffee with them, and you talk about the weather or last night's air raid. But you don't talk so much about what was the nastiest thing you ever said to your mother, or how you pretended to be David Balfour, the hero of Kidnapped, for the whole of the year when you were 13, or what you imagine yourself doing with a pilot who looks like Leslie Howard if you were alone in his bunk after a dance. No one slept the night of that air raid, or the next day. We had pretty much to resurface the runway ourselves that morning. We weren't equipped for it, we didn't have the tools or the materials, and we weren't a building crew. But without a runway, RAF Maidsend was defenseless, and Britain too, in the bigger picture. We repaired the runway. Everyone mucked in, including the captured German. I think he was rather apprehensive about his fate as a prisoner of war and was just as happy to spend the day stripped to the waist, shoveling piles of earth with 20 other pilots than to be moved on to some unknown official internment awaiting him inland. I remember we all had to bow our heads in a moment of silence for his dead companions before we set to work. I don't know what happened to him after that. In the canteen, Queenie was asleep with her head on the table. She must have done up her hair first, before she came in from 2 hours stone-picking on the runway. But she'd fallen asleep before she'd even taken the spoon out of her tea. Maddie sat down across from her with 2 fresh cups of tea and 1 iced bun. I don't know where the icing came from. Someone must have been hoarding sugar just in case there was a direct hit on the airfield, and everybody needed cheering up. Maddie was quite relieved to see the unflappable wireless operator with her guard down. She pushed the cup that cheers close to Queenie's face so that the warmth woke her. They propped their heads on their elbows, facing each other.
Are you scared of anything? Maddie asked. Lots of things.
Name one.
I can name 10.
Go on then.
Queenie looked at her hands. Breaking my nails, she said critically. After 2 hours clearing the runway of rubble and twisted metal, her manicure was in need of repair.
I'm serious, said Maddie quietly.
All right then. Doc, I don't believe you.
It's true, said Queenie. Now your turn.
Cold, Maddie answered. Queenie sipped her tea.
Falling asleep while I'm working.
Me too, Maddie laughed. And bombs dropping.
Too easy.
All right. It was Maddie's turn to be defensive. She shook tangled dark curls off her collar. Her hair was barely short enough to count as regulation and too short to put up.
Bombs dropping on my gran and grandad.
Queenie nodded in agreement.
Bombs dropping on my favorite brother.
Jamie's the youngest of them. The nearest me in age. He's a pilot.
Not having a useful skill, said Maddie. I don't want to have to marry right away just so I don't have to work down Lateral Mill.
You are joking.
When the war's over, I still won't have a skill. Bet there won't be this desperate need for radio operators when the war ends.
You think that'll happen soon?
The longer the war goes on, Maddie said, carefully cutting her iced bun in half with a tin butter knife. The older I'll get.
Queenie let out a giddy, tickled laugh.
Getting old, she cried. I'm horribly afraid of being old.
Maddie smiled and handed her half the bun.
Me too. Bit like being afraid of dying, though. Not much you can do about it.
What am I up to?
You've done 4. Not counting the nails. 6 to go.
All right. Queenie deliberately tore her bun into 6 equal pieces and arranged them round the rim of her saucer. Then one by one, she dunked each piece into her tea, named a fear, and ate it. Number 5. The Newbury College Porter. Blimey, he's a troll. I was a year younger than all the other first years and I'd have been scared of him even if he hadn't hated me. It was because I was reading German and he was sure my tutor was a spy. 5 down, right? Number 6. Heights. I'm afraid of heights. That's because my big brothers tied me to a drain spout on the roof of our castle when I was 5 and forgot about me all afternoon. All 5 of them got a good birching for it too. 7. Ghosts. I mean one ghost, not 7, one particular ghost. I don't need to worry about that here. The ghost is probably why I'm scared of the dark, too. Queenie washed back these unlikely confessions with more tea. Maddie stared at her in growing amazement. They were still eye to eye across from each other with their chins against their hands and their elbows on the table, and Queenie did not seem to be making it up. She was taking her unlikely inventory very seriously. Number 8. Getting caught stealing grapes from the glasshouse in the kitchen garden. That's another birching. Of course, we're all too old now for birchings and for grape stealing. Number 9. Killing someone. By accident or on purpose. Did I save that German laddie's life yesterday or destroy it? You do it too. You tell the fighters where to find them. You're responsible. Do you think about it? Maddie didn't answer. She did think about it. Perhaps it gets easier after the first time. Number 10. Getting lost. Queenie glanced up from dipping getting lost in her tea and looked Maddie in the eye. Now, I can see that you are skeptical and disinclined to believe anything I tell you. And perhaps I'm not really worried about ghosts. But I am afraid of getting lost. I hate trying to find my way around this airfield. Every Nissen hut looks the same. My God, there are 40 of them. And all the taxiways and aprons seem to change every day. I keep trying to use planes for landmarks and they keep moving them around. Maddie laughed. I felt sorry for that lost Jerry pilot yesterday, she said. I know I shouldn't, but I've seen so many of our own lads get confused their first flight over the Pennines. Seems it shouldn't be possible to confuse England and France. But who knows what you're thinking when all your mates have been blown to smithereens and you're flying a broken plane. Perhaps it was his first flight to England. I felt dead sorry for him. Yes, I did too, said Queenie softly, and swallowed the last of her tea as if she were throwing back a dram of whiskey. Was it beastly awful questioning him? Queenie gave her an enigmatic little squint. Careless talk costs lives. I've taken an oath not to tell about it. Oh, Maddie went red. Of course not, sorry. The wireless operator sat up straight. She looked at her ruined nails and shrugged, and patted her hair to make sure it was still in place. Then she stood up and stretched and yawned. Thanks for sharing your bun, she said, smiling. Thanks for sharing your fears. You still owe me a few. The air raid siren went. Or May, 11-11-43, JBS. Not part of the story. I must record last night's debriefing because it was so funny. Engel flapped down my sheaf of scribbled-on hotel stationery in frustration and said to von Linden, "She must be commanded to write of the meeting between Brodert and herself. This description of early radar operations is irrelevant nonsense." Von Linden made a sound like a very soft puff of air, like blowing out a candle. Engel and I both stared at him as though he'd suddenly sprouted horns. It was a laugh. He didn't crack a smile. I think his face is made of plaster of Paris, but he definitely laughed. "Fräulein Engel, you are not a student of literature," he said. "The English flight officer has studied the craft of the novel. She is making use of suspense and foreshadowing." Golly, Engel stared at him. I, of course, took the opportunity to interpose with pig-headed Wallace pride. "I am not English, you ignorant Jerry bastard. I am a Scot." Engel dutifully slapped me into silence and said, "She is not writing a novel, she is making a report."
"But she is employing the literary conceits and techniques of a novel, and the meeting you speak of has already occurred. You have been reading it for the past quarter of an hour."
Engel shuffled pages in frenzy, hunting backwards.
"Do you not recognize her in these pages?"
von Linden prompted.
Perhaps not. She flatters herself with competence and bravery which you have never witnessed. She is the young woman called Queenie, the wireless operator who takes down the Luftwaffe aircraft. Our captive English agent."
"Scottish!" Slap.
"Our prisoner has not yet elaborated on her own role as a wireless operator at the aerodrome at Maid's End."
Oh, he's good. I would never in a million years have guessed that SS Hauptsturmführer Amadeus von Linden is a student of literature. Not in a million years. He wanted to know then why I was choosing to write about myself in the third person. Do you know, I had not even noticed I was doing it until he asked. The simple answer is because I am telling the story from Maddie's point of view, and it would be awkward to introduce another viewpoint character at this point. It is much easier writing about me in the third person than it would be if I tried to tell the story from my own point of view. I can avoid all my old thoughts and feelings. It's a superficial way to write about myself. I don't have to take myself seriously, or, well, only as seriously as Maddie takes me. But as von Linden pointed out, I have not even used my own name, which is what confused Engel. I suppose the real answer is that I am not Queenie anymore. I just want to thump my old self in the face when I think about her, so earnest and self-righteous and flamboyantly heroic. I'm sure other people did too. I am someone else now. They did used to call me Queenie, though. Everybody had stupid nicknames made up for them, like being at school, remember? I was Scotty sometimes, but more often Queenie. That was because Mary, Queen of Scots, is another of my illustrious ancestors. She died messily as well. They all died messily. I am going to run out of stationery today. They have given me a Jewish prescription pad to use until they find something more sensible. I did not know such things existed. The forms have got the doctor's name, Benjamin Zilberberg, at the top, and a yellow star with a warning stamped at the bottom, stating that this Jewish doctor can only legally prescribe medication to other Jews. Presumably he is no longer practicing. Presumably he has been shipped off to break rocks in a concentration camp somewhere, which is why his blank prescriptions have fallen into the hands of the Gestapo. I filled one in. Name: Anna Engel. Address: Fraulein Engel is the required form. I sometimes use on-duty female guard, Mein Führer SIR, to wind her up. Date: not believed ever to have dated. Does she have a sweetheart? Husband? She wears no jewelry. VL has a gold signet with a tiny sapphire in it. Prescription: needs a damned good shagging. She may choose among the following: Maquis Guerrilla, Gestapo, Resistance, German Army, French Milice Police, Civilian. Doctor: Dr. Sigmund Freud. Not Dr. Zilberberg, but still appropriately Jewish. Dose: nightly, 4 or 5 times. I've done her a nicer one as well. Name: Anna Engel. Date: still looking. Prescription: 1 cigarette in ivory holder, 1 magnum champagne, 1 normal bottle would not be enough to loosen her up, Chanel cocktail dress, red is Engel's color, a table at the Hotel Ritz Paris, if the Nazis ever clear out of it. Why are they so fond of ruining perfectly nice hotels? Dose: as needed. I meant to give her a night out, but when I picture this scenario, it makes me think of Mata Hari on a mission. Would Engel be happier as a spy, glamorous and deadly? I just can't imagine her in any role other than beastly punctilious official. Also, I can't say that the bleak aftermath of a special agent's unsuccessful mission has anything to recommend it. I was going to do prescriptions for William Wallace and Mary Queen of Scots and Adolf Hitler too, but I can't think of anything clever enough to make it worth the reprisals for the waste of paper. Coffee would be at the top of my own prescription list. Then aspirin. I'm running a fever. It won't be tetanus, as they inoculated us, but maybe septicemia. I don't think those pins were very clean. There was one I missed for a while after I pulled the others out, and the spot is very sore now. I am a little worried about some of the burns, too, which chafe when my wrist hits the table as I write. Perhaps I will die quietly of blood poisoning and avoid the kerosene treatment. There's no efficient way to kill yourself with a dressmaker's pin. I wouldn't call contracting gangrene an efficient way to kill yourself. I puzzled over it for a long time, seeing as they'd left the pins there, but it's just not possible. Useful for picking locks, though. I so loved the burglary lessons we got when we were training. Didn't so much enjoy the bleak aftermath of my unsuccessful attempt to put them to use. Very good at picking locks, but not so good at getting out of the building. Our prison cells are only hotel bedrooms, but we are guarded like royalty. And also, there are dogs. After that episode with the pins, they had a good go at making sure I wouldn't be able to walk if I did manage to get out. Don't know where you pick up the skills for disabling a person without actually breaking her legs. Nazi school of assault and battery? Like everything else, it wasn't permanent damage. Nothing left this week but the bruises. And they check me carefully now for stray bits of metal. I got caught yesterday trying to hide a pen nib in my hair. I didn't have a plan for it, but you never know. Oh, often I forget I am not writing this for myself, and then it's too late to scratch it out. The evil Engel always snatches everything away from me and raises an alarm if she sees me trying to retract anything. Yesterday, I tried ripping off the bottom of the page and eating it, but she got to it first. It was when I realized I had thoughtlessly mentioned the factory at Swinley. It is refreshing sometimes to fight with her. She has the advantage of freedom, but I'm a lot more imaginative. Also, I'm willing to use my teeth, which she is squeamish about. Where was I? Hauptsturmfuhrer von Linden has taken away everything I wrote yesterday. It is your own fault, you cold and soulless Jerry bastard, if I repeat myself. Miss Engel has reminded me. The air red siren went. Clever girl. She's been paying attention. She makes me give her every page to read now as soon as I have finished with it. We had fun doing the prescriptions. Will it get her in trouble if I mention that she burned a few herself to get rid of them this time? That'll teach you to try and make a chum of me, on-duty female guard Engel. I have already got her in trouble, without knowing I was doing it, by mentioning her cigarettes. She's not allowed to smoke while she is on duty. Apparently Adolf Hitler has a vendetta against tobacco, finds it filthy and disgusting, and his military police and their assistants are not meant to smoke at work. I don't think this is too strictly enforced, except when the place is run by an obsessive martinet like Amadeus von Linden. Shame for him, really, as a lit cigarette is such a convenient accessory if your job happens to be extracting information from enemy intelligence agents. As long as Engel's crimes are also minor, they won't get rid of her, because her combined talents would be quite difficult to replace, a bit like mine. But her offences do consistently fall under insubordination. Anti-aircraft gunner. The air raid siren went. Every head in the room looked up in dismay and exhaustion at the canteen's pasteboard ceiling as if they could see through it. Then everybody rocketed from their borrowed church hall wooden folding chairs to meet the next battle. Maddie stood facing her new friend by the table they had just abandoned, people around her whirling into action. She felt as though she were at the eye of a tropical storm, the still point of the turning world. "Come on!" Queenie cried, just like the Red Queen in Through the Looking Glass, and grabbed Maddie by the arm to pull her outside. "You go on duty at one. What have you got?" She glanced at her watch. "An hour? Quick nap in the shelter before they need you in the radio room. Pity you haven't brought your brolly along. Come on, I'll go with you." The pilots were already racing for the Spitfires, and Maddie tried to fix her mind on the practical problem of how best to take off from the half-mended runway. Taxiing would be the hardest, as you wouldn't be able to see the holes in the surface past the high nose of the little fighter planes. She tried not to think about what it would be like running across the airfield to the radio room an hour from now, under fire. But she did it. Because you do. It is incredible what you do, knowing you have to. A bit less than an hour later, to allow themselves some extra time for dodging bombs, the two girls were outside again, in the moonscape that was now RAF Maidsend. Queenie steered Maddie at a trot, both of them bent nearly double, hugging the sides of buildings and zigzagging across the open spaces. They'd heard how during the retreat from France the low-flying planes of the Luftwaffe would strafe people on the ground with machine gun fire, just for the hell of it, and right now there were two or three German fighters buzzing low over the runway, like wasps, with the sun on their wings, drilling holes in windows and parked aircraft. "Over here! Here!" someone yelled desperately. "Hey, you two, come and help, here!" For a few seconds, Maddie, doggedly coping with her own private hell of rational or irrational fear, did not even notice Queenie's change of direction as she headed towards the cry for help. Then sense came back to Maddie for a minute, and she realized that Queenie was dragging her to the nearest anti-aircraft gun emplacement. Or what was left of it. Most of the protective concrete barrier and the sandbags surrounding it had been blown to bits, taking with it two of the army gunners who had been valiantly trying to keep the runway fit for the Spitfire squadron, who would have to land there after the battle. One of the dead gunners was easily younger than Maddie. A third man, who was still standing, looked like a butcher, without the apron, soaked from neck to thighs in blood. He turned wearily and said, "Thanks for the relief. I'm beat." Then he sat down on the ruined platform and closed his eyes. Maddie cowered next to him, her arms over her head, listening to the hideous rattle of the gunner sucking air into blood-filled lungs. Queenie slapped her. "Get up, girl," she ordered. "I won't have this. I'm your superior officer giving orders now. Get up, Brodett. If you're scared, do something. See if you can make this gun work. Get moving!" "The shell needs loading first," the gunner whispered, lifting a finger to point. "The Prime Minister don't like girls firing guns."
"Bother the Prime Minister," exclaimed the superior officer. "Load the damned gun, Brodett."
Maddie, nothing if not mechanically minded and trained to react positively to orders from people in authority, clawed her way up the gun.
"That slip of a lass'll never shift that shell," croaked the gunner. "Weighs 30 pounds, that does."
Maddie wasn't listening. She was reckoning. After a minute's rational thought, and with strength that she later couldn't explain, she loaded the shell. Queenie worked frantically over the fallen gunner, trying to plug the holes in his chest and stomach. Maddie did not watch. After some time, Queenie took her by the shoulders and showed her how to aim.
"You've got to anticipate. It's like shooting birds. You have to fire a little ahead of where they'll be next."
"Shoot a lot of birds, do you?" Maddie gasped, anger and fear making her peevish about the other girl's seemingly limitless talents. "I was born in the middle of a grouse moor on the opening day of the shooting season. I could fire a gun before I could read. But this poxy thing is just a wee bit bigger than a Diana air rifle, and I don't know how it works, so we have to do it together. Like yesterday, all right?"
She gave a sudden gasp and asked anxiously,
"That's not one of our planes, is it?"
"Can't you tell?"
"Not really."
Maddie relented.
"It's a Messerschmitt 109.
"Well, clobber it! Point this way! Now wait till he comes back. He doesn't know this station's still operational. Just wait."
Maddie waited. Queenie was right. Doing something, focusing, took away the fear.
"Now, go!"
The blast momentarily blinded them both. They did not see what happened. Maddie swore afterwards that the plane did not go down in a ball of flame until it had made at least two more passes over the runway. But no one else ever claimed to have shot down that ME-109.
Oh, how many aircraft I know after all.
And God knows the fighter pilots were a competitive lot of bean counters. So that kill, I expect the Luftwaffe also call it a kill when someone shoots down a plane, like deer, was credited to two off-duty WAF officers working together at an unmanned gun station.
"I don't think our gun did that," Maddie told her friend, way-faced, as the black, oily smoke rose from the turnip field where the plane had come down. "It must have been one of our lot, firing from the air. And if it was this gun, it wasn't you."
It was bad enough she suspected the reason Queenie was at her side now was because she'd had to give up on the lad whose gun they'd taken over. Bad enough. But there had also been a pilot in that ball of flame. A living young man with not much more training than Maddie herself.
"Stay here," Queenie choked. "Can you load another shell? I'll find someone who knows what they're doing to take over. You'll be needed in the tower now."
Queenie paused a moment.
"Which way to the northeast air raid shelter from here?" she asked anxiously. "I get so muddled in the smoke."
Maddie pointed. "Straight line across the grass. Easy peasy if you're brave enough. Like finding Neverland. Second to the right, then straight on till morning."
"What about you? Brave enough?"
"I'll be all right, now I've got something to do."
They both ducked instinctively as something exploded at the other end of the runway. Queenie squeezed Maddie round the waist and gave her a quick peck on the cheek.
"Kiss me, Hardy. Weren't those Nelson's last words at the Battle of Trafalgar? Don't cry. We're still alive, and we make a sensational team."
Then she hitched up her hair to its 2-inch above the collar regulation point, swabbed her own tears and the grease and the concrete dust and the gunner's blood from her cheeks with the back of her hand, and she was off running again, like the Red Queen. It's like being in love, discovering your best friend.
"Get your mac on," Maddie said. "I'm going to teach you to navigate."
Queenie burst out laughing.
"Impossible." "Not impossible. There's a couple of pilots here who scrapped their way out of Poland after it was invaded. They got here with no maps, no food, no language other than Polish.
They'll tell you all about it if you let them. Bit tricky making sense of their English. Anyway, if a couple of escaped prisoners can find their way across Europe and become RAF pilots, you can..."
"You talk to the pilots?" Queenie interrupted with interest.
"There are other things you can do besides dance with them."
"Yes, but talking? How unimaginative."
"Some of them won't dance, you know, so you have to talk. That Vickers boy won't dance. Hard to get him to talk either, but they all like jawing about maps. Or lack of maps. Come on, you don't need a map. We've got the whole day. As long as we don't go anywhere more than 5 miles away, so I can get back sharpish if the weather clears.
But look at it."
Maddie waved at the window. It was pouring. Rain coming down in sheets, a gale blowing.
"Just like home," Queenie said happily. "You don't get proper Scotch mist in Switzerland."
Maddie snorted. Queenie was devoted to careless name-dropping, scattering the details of her privileged upbringing without the faintest hint of modesty or embarrassment. Though after a while, Maddie began to realize she only did it with people she liked or people she detested. Those who didn't mind and those she didn't care about. Anyone in between or who might have been offended she was more cautious with.
"I've got bicycles," Maddie said. "A couple of the mechanics let me borrow them. Rain doesn't stop those lads working."
"Where are we going?"
"The Green Man. Pub at the foot of the cliffs on St. Catherine's Bay. Last chance before it shuts down next week. The proprietor's fed up being fired at. Not by the Germans, mind you. It's our own lads drilling the pub sign out there on the edge of the shingle. Last thing before they head home after a battle. They do it for luck."
"Bet they do it to get rid of unused ammunition." "Well, it's a landmark, and you're the navigator. Find the coast and go south, easy peasy. You can use my compass. If you can't find it, I'm afraid it'll be nout but cold beans straight from the tin for your dinner."
"That's not fair. I'm back on shift at 11 tonight."
Maddie rolled her eyes.
"Bloomin' heck, that leaves us only about 15 hours for a 10-mile pushback ride. But it'll give me a chance to finish telling you my fears."
Maddie had her man's greatcoat on and was tying it up round her ankles so it wouldn't catch in the bicycle chain.
"I hope you've got a tin opener," Queenie said ominously, struggling into her own greatcoat. "And a spoon."
It was astonishing, after 10 minutes pedalling away from RAF Maidsend, how peaceful the drenched Kent countryside was. It was true that every now and then you passed a concrete gun emplacement or watchtower, but mostly you were just travelling through rolling, chalky fields,
green with turnips and potatoes, and mile upon mile of orchards.
Might have brought your brolly, Queenie said. I'm saving it for the next air raid.
They came to a crossroads. There were no road signs, not one. They'd all been taken down or blacked over to confuse the enemy in the event operation.